Meadowlarks are the canary of the prairie, where one hears their song it is safe to go out onto the prairie. But where their song is no longer heard, there is danger on the prairie. And so we ask, can people grow enough food to eat while the meadowlark still sings?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1358th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down in there in Poor Veneer who are tuned in on the Food Chain as we stream along at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with producer Vanessa as well on the stories. Good morning, Vanessa. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. I'm good.
All right. Folks, having grown up on the slice of the geography that lies between the peaks of the Rocky Mountains and the grasslands of the high prairie, I learned at a very early age to take great joy in the song of the meadowlark. The yellow-breasted, robin-sized bird's song can be heard from quite a distance. And whenever I hear that song, it brings a moment of joy to whatever I happen to be doing at the time. And I always try to whistle a reply, although you can't do that very well unless your whistle is suitably wet. But I do love trying it. However, the song of the meadowlark is becoming ever more difficult to hear for pretty much the same reason that buffalo no longer eat the prairie grasses. People in their agriculture have moved in, and most of the meadowlarks and many of their bird kindred have been forced to move out, thus portending that silent spring of which we heard so much about in the past. And so the canary of the prairie leads us to ask, can people grow enough food to eat while the meadowlark sings? Who better to ask than ornithologist John Marsloff, who is the Emeritus Professor of Forest Sciences at the University of Washington and author of In Search of Meadowlarks. John, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Well, last week we talked about the corvids of Yellowstone, the crows and the great big huge ones,
the ravens,
the crows and the ravens of Yellowstone, and how they spend their winter. And it is winter up there, and as you experience a recent snowfall, it's a beautiful sight to behold when that sun strikes that fresh white snow. And when the corvids are flying about Yellowstone in those conditions, they were really a stark contrast to the countryside up there. But now you're off in search of the prairie's canary, as I like to think of them, because they kind of are, the meadowlark. Well, and I have to wonder, did something fall on your head along the way, an apple perhaps, that led you to turn from the corvids of our countryside to the meadowlarks? It's quite a transition.
No, I mean, I'm interested in lots of different birds for sure. I mean, corvids always hold a special place and are the topic of detailed research. But I like you, grew up in prairie country and, you know, learned the song of the meadowlark at an early age. Loved to see those birds perched on a fence post, shining bright yellow and black from their breast. And the concern of the loss of birds has been an important part of my research over the years, and the prairies exemplify that, unfortunately, to the extreme.
And that's probably going to be where we're headed today, the loss of our birds on the prairie and just about everywhere when it gets right down to it. But before we do, I'd like to grab you as an ornithologist for a little bit of conversation about what it is to be an ornithologist. And I'm especially interested in how you bird a property.
Yeah, well, I like to spend some time there. I'm not there just to to get a list of everything possible, but to watch things in a little more detail. So I go slow, look in the places where different habitats collide. You might get a greater diversity of birds there, and watch for behavior. And that's, you know, again, why the corvids stand out to me. They're always doing fun things. There's ravens zipping around looking for a meal or maybe playing chase with one another. There would be other beautiful birds singing. I love to see the warblers working the forest there, or the meadowlarks out in the more open country, as we've said. But I go slow and watch and try to see what the animals are doing, not just who's there.
Well, I have an occasion to watch birders as they slowly walk along with their field glasses in hand, and they all seem to be going slow. So perhaps it's a good way for those of us who are moving too fast to slow down a little bit, grab a pair of field glasses and go for a slow walk and see what you
can see.
But you talk about more about listening to what you hear than to seeing what you can see.
Yeah, I think all good birders or naturalists listen a lot. And for birds, especially when you're in more forested, less open environments, we do almost all of our scientific counting by ear. We typically will record all the birds we hear or see within some fixed distance from us. But yeah, the ears are important, and unfortunately, they tend to dull a little bit with age.
Well, all you need to do is get a pair of good hearing aids, because they accentuate bird calls. It's amazing.
Yeah, I've got to try that. And of course, some people now are using apps that'll record and identify bird song as well while you're out there, which is a good tool to learn, but also to question what you're actually, what they're saying you're hearing.
Now, can you actually tell the difference, for example, between two meadowlarks?
The two individuals or two species?
Two individuals.
Maybe if they have some peculiarities in your area. They are territorial, and those males are singing to advertise their territory ownership and potential availability as a mate. So they might have some peculiarities that you can tell, but I have not heard very distinct differences in the meadowlark song like with some of the raven calls.
Mm-hmm. And are you ever able to find a nest of the birds that you're birding?
Yes, I mean, I spend a lot of time finding and then monitoring nests, because of course the birds are here in the summertime to breed and to contribute to the next generation. That's how they succeed as a species. So we spend a lot of time finding nests, carefully assessing their success. I used to climb a lot of nests and count eggs and weigh them and measure them. And that seems a lot less important these days to me than just how many young they actually produce out of that nest. So I'll tend to find a nest, mark it with a GPS locator so I know where it's at and I can find it again without leaving some clue to it out in the field. And then check back and make sure that it's still active, and eventually how many young fledge or leave that nest. That's a key thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, on a personal note, my wife really dislikes crows because, she says, they eat all the songbird babies.
And she has a point, up to a point. Crows and ravens and magpies do all prey upon eggs and nestlings of other birds. We've done lots of work to try to relate the abundance of crows in specific to the success of other birds, and it doesn't shake out very well. What typically happens is that we go in and we convert land. We convert it to housing or a farm or whatever it is. And that sees a decline in some species and an increase in others. And people are quick to say, that increase due to subdivision or farming, that increase in crows is the reason other birds are declining. But it's really not. It's the change in habitat that's the main driver. Mm-hmm. And yes, crows do prey upon some Yes, and they do exert a toll on the birds that nest there, and that can be severe in some places, but it pales in comparison to the habitat change.
Which leads us to the topic of your book, In Search of the Meadowlark. What led you to take that search, John Marsloo?
A couple of things. One, I had a real interest in how farmers were using their lands and how that meshed with the wildlife that was there, just from traveling with students to various farms and ranches around the world, and visiting with my daughter, who's a farmer in Western Washington, to see what was going on their lands. And secondly, as we said earlier, the prairie birds have been a source of great decline. And so I thought it was important to spend some intellectual effort to understand that better, to see what solutions might lie ahead for balancing food and wildlife.
Well, with respect to the prairie, there's a lot of prairie and not much urban development in it. So it must be something else than other than just urban development that's leading to the disappearance. And you do make mention that meadowlarks are disappearing in great numbers. Do you have a handle on that?
Yeah, they've declined greatly. The eastern meadowlark in particular has declined, to its lowest levels now, somewhere in the order of a 80% decline over the last 30 or 40 years that they've been counted in some systematic sort of way. I went on one of those count routes. We have across the U.S. and Canada and Mexico several thousand routes that people run every breeding season and count birds on those that are nesting and using the area. I ran one of those in Illinois for meadowlarks, and I only saw six larks over a 50-mile stretch. And that was compared to, numbers in the past that would have been 40 or 50. So a tenfold decline almost in those places. And that's pretty typical. But the eastern meadowlark, which is more from the Mississippi east, is declined more than the western meadowlark. The eastern meadowlark really, its habitats have been greatly reduced by not only settlement, but of course, agriculture. Whereas the western meadowlark can live in some of these mountainous open areas, sagebrush, and places like that, which have also declined greatly, but there's more of that habitat still available for the western.
Some years ago, must have been 60, maybe even 70 years ago, Rachel Carson's made mention of the fact that we're facing a silent spring in which we would no longer hear the sound of our songbirds. And here we are, some decades later, seemingly faced with that silent spring when we're losing 85% of meadowlarks as a canary in the prairie, as it were. It seems to be we're really facing some substantial loss here. Well, that's what we're going to pick up, because we can do that on the food chain. And I will look forward to picking up the subject with John Marsloo, who is the author of In Search of the Meadowlark. But even more than that, In Search of a Way to Keep the Meadowlark Singing While We Find a Way to Eat Our Food. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, give a listen to the meadowlark. Some time ago, Rachel Carson suggested that we're going to be losing the song of our birds by virtue of the way we grow our food. And so we got rid of a few different pesticides and moved right along. But we're still losing, and it appears to be, we're losing them to a great extent. Is that a fair assessment, John Marsloo?
Absolutely.
And what is it about the way we grow our food that's causing this decline in the song of our birds?
Well, as you said, Rachel Carson pointed out the role of pesticides in reducing some birds, and certainly that was a very important issue and remains so. as you said, we've gotten rid of some of those, some of the most deadly pesticides like DDT. Unfortunately, others remain. And what we're seeing now is really the industrialization of agriculture, not only here in North America on our prairies, but around the world, where we're farming every bit of land that exists out there, no longer leaving some rough edges around farms or some uncultivated land within farms. And we are using herbicides like Roundup, which remove the need to be out weeding, remove the weeds from the fields, which provide important seeds and insects that birds eat. So it is still a pesticide or herbicide issue that we're dealing with, but it's also the industrialization of how we use the land and how little of it we leave around to be just a tad bit wild, which would be enough for an awful lot of birds to utilize.
How does what we eat relate to this industrialization of our land and our environment?
Well, you might think it's all about what we eat, but in fact, in the Midwestern U.S. and prairies of Canada, most of what we grow there, corn and soybeans, are not used for food. Only about 3% of the corn we grow, we actually eat. The rest of it we use to feed our cattle, which we then eat, or we use as a substrate to produce ethanol for a supplement to our gasoline, which would, again, seem like a good environmentally conscious thing to do, not using fossil fuels for that. But in fact, the amount of land that's utilized for ethanol production is tremendous and again, a very severe cause of decline for birds.
So then with respect to what we actually eat, a lot of what we actually eat isn't a direct consequence of this industrial form of agriculture. It's the other uses that are being made of those crops, such as corn, where we put them in our gas tank.
Yeah, that's the biggest land consumer of crops for sure right now. And that's because it's incentivized. Farmers are, business people that have to make a living out on the land, and they produce what they get the most money for in many cases, not all. But right now, the way the government incentivizes the production of corn and soybeans for fuel or cow food forces farmers to make that decision and grow those crops rather than maybe a greater diversity of crops that would benefit more people directly and also more wildlife.
It's interesting because the grandparents' farm near Belfry, Montana, was one of those kinds of farms you probably only find in Amish country these days, in that it had many different things growing, animals, plants, and people, all seemed to be working together. And yet, that farm, of course, is gone, because the government came in to the countryside there and began farming, subsidizing the growth of sugar beets.
Ah.
And that, so to survive in that marketplace, you had to grow sugar beets because that's what you got paid to do. So that great, sustainable kind of diversity that once was there is now gone, and fence post to fence post, sugar beets.
Yep. And in Nebraska, where I started my search for meadowlarks, we saw the same thing. The farmers there used to have a diversity, just as you said, on their lands of animals and plants, and now it's been subsidized to be just corn and soybean.
Well, whenever you subsidize anything, you, in essence, distort its value. So when we subsidize the growth of corn and soybean and whatnot that the government decides to subsidize, we're really distorting the value of those crops. We're assigning them more value than the market would otherwise give them. And so, in essence, then, the government is forcing this industrialization on the countryside. Or am I stretching it a little bit?
No, I think that's true, certainly in the Midwestern U.S. And as you gave the example of sugar beets in the West, what I found talking to the farmers that are working my wife's grandparents' land, still in Nebraska, was that they could make $400 to $600 an acre for corn or soybeans because of those subsidies. Whereas if they were to put the land aside for wildlife, which is another government program, the Conservation Reserve Program, where they could plant grasses and forbs that are beneficial for birds, they would only be making about $150 an acre. So you can do the math. It's pretty simple. And like you said, the farmer has to go where the benefit is if they're going to stay in business. And so that's what they do.
Now, is anybody asking if we need the government to be subsidizing these crops? Other than farmers, of course, right?
Sure, yes. I mean, lots of economists, lots of those concerned with the sustainability of the land and of wild populations certainly are asking those questions and investigating them in much more detail than I do, for sure.
Okay. Well, in search of the meadowlark, first took you to Nebraska, which is your home turf. What did you see?
What I saw was a lot of corn and soybean. my strategy throughout these farms and ranches that I visited was to camp out there. So I put my tent out in a field of soybeans and spent the night. And yeah, as you can guess, it's not the most scenic place to camp, but it was pretty cool. There was, there were some amphibians and reptiles around. There were some birds, but they were mostly forest birds, not prairie birds. So the bits of remaining habitat in this case are around the houses, the farmhouses there. And those tend to be treed areas where you have, great horned owls and red-tailed hawks and robins and some woodpeckers, which is great, but it's not the typical assembly of birds that we would expect there.
You know, it's interesting. One of the best places to raise bees is in the city, because of the diversity of flora in the city is far exceeds that out in the country where they grow crops. So out in the country, you might have one crop for the bees to feed on, and when that crop's gone, there's nothing for the bees to feed on. But in the city, everybody's growing everything, so there's a lot for them to consume there. Kind of the same for Nebraska then.
It's the same for birds. I would say in general, we have higher diversity in our, not the densest part of a city, but the suburban areas around it, certainly because of that diversity of plantings and activities. There's just more resources available for different species of birds.
Where did your search lead you next?
Next, I headed kind of to your home turf in Montana, at the headwaters of the Missouri River, where wheat is a major crop. And wheat around the world is a challenge for resources in that it utilizes a lot of water. And so I kind of expected to see another example of industrial agriculture here, but I found, in fact, that the farmers where I went don't rely upon groundwater to irrigate their land, but instead they do dryland farming, which requires rainfall and snowfall, as I'm looking at now, to seep into the soil and provide enough moisture to raise wheat. And that doesn't happen every year.
It doesn't, does it? Sometimes it's just not there. And we were talking a little bit about the difference between the prairie and the city. And ironically, it turns out that the city is probably the more fecund place to raise just about everything because of what we have done to the countryside. But not all countryside and not all farmers are practicing those industrial methods. In Montana, John Marslove found farmers who were practicing a different kind of cultivation practices with respect to wheat. Is that correct, John?
That's right. You would expect wheat to be quite damaging to the environment because of the water that it uses. But in parts of Montana, where I went at the headwaters of the Missouri River, farmers there are doing what's called dry land farming out of necessity, because a well would have to be too deep to be practical to irrigate their crops. But they let the rain and snow moisten the ground and accumulate moisture over a couple of years that then allows them to raise a crop of wheat. Mm-hmm. What I found very important was in between those years when the land is fallow, that is no crops planted and growing, it's good habitat for species such as hornlarks.
And we used to call it strip farming, where you have a strip of land that you plant, and you grow the wheat there, and then the next strip over is fallow, and that fallow land provides that habitat, and therefore you can have birds and other critters.
Right. And that juxtaposition is really a key thing as well, in that you've got some land that's producing seeds and other things that the birds could use as well, and other places for them to nest that fallow land.
And so from there, you also are growing, you ran into different kind of beef ranchers there too as well, correct?
That's true. A bit more traditional here in Montana, where this was I went to two different cattle ranches. One was a cow-calf operation where they raised their cattle up through the summer and autumn and then send them to feedlots to eat that industrial raised corn. So that wasn't so great as far as beef production. But this farmer was really innovative in establishing a way to have his herd in proximity to a very productive spring creek. And he made special crossings of gravel for the cattle to go and utilize the water without muddying it up and making it too murky for the fish. And he did rotational grazing, which was to intensively graze areas for short periods of time, then move his cattle to another pasture. And as that formerly grazed pasture was regenerating, birds were using it quite a lot, like bobolinks, which have declined in other places.
So it's really intent that we're looking at here. Is it possible, I guess that's a question that I ask of the day, is it possible for us to grow enough food while the birds still sing? Or do we have to get rid of all the birds?
No, we've got to be able to do some of both. And basically, it's a strategy that's been termed in the academic literature to either share the land or to spare the land. And sparing it would be to basically do away with agriculture and allow that wild land to support biodiversity. Sharing the land is more like the strip farming you described, where some of it is available for wildlife and some of it's producing for agriculture. And the rest of my travels were really with farmers that are actively sharing their land with wildlife and still producing an abundance of food. That it's certainly a possible thing to do. There are some changes we need to make, but to share land with wildlife, to spare some of it for very sensitive wildlife, is a possibility, even with our expanding and increasingly affluent human population.
So in China, they were able to do it for 4,000 years.
Right.
To do both. And then they discovered industrial agriculture, and probably not so much anymore, from what I've seen. And that's what we're faced here is that we have these wonderful industrial methods of growing food that don't require people so much as it does equipment and chemicals and whatnot. And my fear is that when you take people off the land, that they don't really see what's happening to the land. And it's easier for them to, if you don't see what's happening to the land, it's easier for them to turn their back on what is happening to the land. But as you say, not everybody's doing it this way. So we're going to take a quick break coming up here in a moment. But when we come back, I'd like to Have you given us some ideas on what people are actually doing out there to grow food and still allow for the song of the birds? Like, for example, meadowlark. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with producer Vanessa and John Marsleff, of Emeritus Professor of Forest Sciences at the University of Washington. And we will be right back after these brief messages.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. We have with us Professor Emeritus of Forest Sciences, John Marsleff. He, the world expert, I think, of crows and all kinds of corvids, of which we all love because of their cleverness and the way they take over their world and rule it in many respects. But now we're following the meadowlark. And we also want to thank Vanessa Salas for putting this show together with John Marsleff. John, here in the Monterey Bay Area of California, there's an organization called the Wild Farm Alliance.
Yep.
And what they suggest, in addition to hedgerow farms, so what these two organizations do is suggest, in some of the most expensive ag land in the world, that farmers set aside some of their agricultural resources for wildlife. And so it's a very interesting conflict, because the farmers, who by and large don't own this land anymore, by mostly just rent it for a lot of money, are faced with the prospect of having to do whatever they can to make money with that a very expensive farmland. And tending to the birds isn't the top of their list. But the Wild Farm Alliance and Hedgerows Unlimited suggest that it's a thing for them to do. So how would you suggest that they sell this to this notion to farmers who are forced by the bottom line economics to take the most out of that land?
Well, I went to several situations in California that showed farmers doing exactly that, providing some habitat for wildlife while still getting a significant return on their lands. Some of them were, in fact, the hedgerows example that you say. And this is a case, again, where it's a win-win for the wildlife and the farmer. They allow some habitat, whether it's grassy flowers and such along the road, or it's an actual windbreak of trees that allows habitat for birds and pollinators, which provide a service to their lands. So they've shown through lots of experiments that having these hedgerows provides for birds to stay there that then forage on insects that would be preying upon the crops that the farmers are growing. And by having those hedgerows, they save money by not having to use as much pesticide. They could market their crops as wildlife friendly or organic, and therefore get a premium price for them. So having this win-win situation where the farmer does something that benefits them and wildlife is a key. The other great example of that was in the wine country, where vintners are putting up owl boxes for barn owls to nest in. And those barn owls that are raising their chicks in these nest boxes along the vineyards are basically out eating 1,000 rodents a season, each pair of owls, which reduces the need for, again, trapping or poisoning of these rodents that could damage the vines or equipment that has to go over rough ground left by the rodents. And so the farmers benefit. They can sell this benefit as, you know, you might see some wine labels that have a barn owl on the front. And those are appealing to people that want to conserve nature. So by showing, by the farmer showing the consumer that they're doing the right thing, us as consumers can help benefit the farmer by paying a bit more for that sort of farming as well.
You know, it occurs to me, the more the farmer uses the environment to grow the crops, as you suggest, by adding barn owls, for example, the more clever they have to be.
More in tune with the land.
Exactly.
I think what you said. And being on the land, the farmers and ranchers I went to, they are there on the land, the ones that are doing these things. And they enjoy going out and seeing how the crop is coming along. And they're proud of what they're able to do. And they're super proud of the wildlife that's there as well.
Well, I always suggest that the best thing for all of us city people to do is to learn how to buy real food grown in real soil by real farmers. Yeah. And if we can figure out how to do that, I think we will do a lot to rectify what we have done to the soil through our industrial methods.
I agree. I mean, I would even go so far as to say you should try to know your farmer.
Yes.
And we've seen, you know, in our lifetimes, Michael, seen a great increase in the ability to do this by having profiles of farmers at stores that we shop at or going to farmers markets much more easily today than a few years ago anyway, and be able to meet those producers.
I would suggest that if you can look into the farmer's eye, you can see what's really in the food, right? Because you can't lie. And I don't think it's ever been the case that the farmer could get away with lying for very long when it gets right down to it. Because you first of all, you're working with nature, and you're working with soil. And all of these things, they just don't lie. And so I just, Thomas Jefferson made note of the fact that the farmer should be held up to everybody by virtue of his or her virtues. And I always thought that was pretty clever. But what you say is that we city people have the opportunity to really shape what's going on in the countryside.
We do. Our purchase power is significant. I mean, subsidies aside, we're the ones putting the price on what we're willing to pay for something. So, and I think the more you see the land that your farmer is utilizing, and as you say, get to meet them and look into their eyes, but also to look at their lands and see what do they look like? Do they have animals on them, or are they just, wall-to-wall crop? That allows us to reward the sorts of practices that we value. Mm-hmm.
Now, beef cattle are being held up as the enemy of the environment these days. Your comment?
Sure. I would comment on that. There are different kinds of beef cattle out there. I am not a vegetarian. It would be great for the environment if we all were, and if we were all vegans, it'd be even better. But that's a high bar to ask. And we don't need to all do that to be able to still enjoy some meat. But the big thing about beef is to treat it as a luxury, not as a daily necessity. You know, if you eat a little bit once a week, we can sustain that sort of production. But thinking about what your cattle are eating is a key thing. Is it grain-fed beef? That's a significant effect on the environment, as we talked about with all the corn and soybeans that are raised in the Midwest. That corn production is going to feed those cattle, and they are burping lots of methane, which increases greenhouse gases and global warming. Cattle that are eating grass, much like bison did for centuries and millennia, They are having much less of an effect. They still produce methane. They are ruminants and produce methane, but they're not causing a degradation of the land like the conversion of the entire prairie system to corn. They instead are grazing the native grasses that are out there, and that provides a lot of habitat for other animals. And even better, step into the world of eating bison. That's where I've gone, and I find it delicious, and I feel good about seeing my herd of bison out grazing on the prairies here in Montana, and knowing that that I'm willing to pay a premium and able to pay that premium to sustain that sort of farming culture.
It's interesting. I just got back from visiting my daughter in metropolitan Virginia. Mm. And she fed us bison, grass-fed bison, elk, and venison. And she knew the farmers who grew them, though they were in states far away from Virginia. Yeah. And it's amazing what we can know about our farmers now that we probably never could know, and especially can never know in the industrial processes of the industrial agriculture, where nobody knows the animals.
Yeah, you're too far away from it to experience that for sure. It's hidden.
So in your search of the meadowlark, what did you find?
Well, I found that farmers want to do the right thing, and many of them do the right thing for their land and for the other animals that use it.
At least some farmers, right?
At least some farmers.
So just the ones we want to patronize, those.
I think that's the best world would be for us to be able to identify farmers that are doing right on their land and reward them for those efforts. Absolutely. And I think that will go a long way into having more farmers do that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Well, is there any way for us to contend with the subsidies of industrial agriculture? After all, that's our money.
Exactly. And it's our policies. And we do live in a democracy. Maybe it's degraded a bit these days, but we do live in a democracy. And our representatives are the ones that fund and craft the annual or biannual farm bills, which fund those sorts of subsidies and subsidies for doing the right thing to the land. And as voters, I think we should lobby strongly our political representatives to do the right thing for the farm bill, for example. That would go a long way in being able to incentivize farmers to grow crops in harmony with nature rather than in opposition to it.
That would be an interesting political party that I would like to be involved with. if we could catch one together, we'll have to come up with a name for it and start one. So that's quite a career you've had, John Marslove, of following birds around. I don't think you worked a day in your life, have you?
No, absolutely not. I totally agree with you. It's been a pleasure to do these sorts of investigations and have the time to delve into things a little more deeply.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that being the case, I have to ask you the question that's been on my mind. If you could be any bird in the world, which one would it be?
I guess it would probably be the raven, simply because they can cover such large areas. They know their lands inside and outside when everything is occurring. So to have that sort of knowledge of the geography that you live in would be wonderful, and be able to have time to play.
They
and
do.
Ravens are one of the few birds that have time to play, that would be fabulous.
And they do because they know how to control their land. What was it you called them? The king of the forest.
Sure, they are the avian kings of the forest for sure.
Now, what next for John Marslove?
Well, back to ravens a little more seriously here in Yellowstone to try to understand how ravens are using wolves and people, not only farmland, but other aspects, hunters here in particular, and how ravens utilize elk hunters versus wolves on a given day-to-day basis.
And it's all about controlling their land, right? And controlling their environment. They kind of follow what's going on and figure out how to use it.
They understand it, absolutely, and they remember it. And they put that information to use so that they can survive and live with us and among us.
Maybe we can all learn from ravens as we move along. What about the meadowlark? Do you see any hope for the songbirds?
I see hope, Michael. I mean, if I didn't, I'd be out of here. So I see hope in that I do see things changing. I see these animals adapting on one hand to some of the challenges we pose to them, living in our cities, for example, as we mentioned earlier. And I see people adapting and valuing being able to see these animals, and so causing change in farming practices and other things that would allow these animals to survive among us. So I see hope, not for all species. The prairie species are in tough shape, and meadowlarks, we may lose the eastern meadowlark.
Wow.
And that would be super sad for people who don't have the song of either the eastern or western to
just
to
like Rachel
to.
Carson said, silent spring. John Marslove, thank you so much for all of that you have done for helping us understand birds and environment. And Vanessa Salas, thank you for putting together the show. Much appreciated. One last song. Thank you all for tuning in. The Food Chain Radio Program. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.